Our text today is Psalm 141. It is a psalm that gives us another window into David's earnestness. Don't miss that. It's a crucial key to this psalm. David is in earnest, crying out to the Lord, like we see him do when his enemies are seeking his life. David is very near death and crying out to the Lord. Here, though, David shows you the same earnestness, and it's about his own sin, in his battle against sin. And so, please don't miss, don't let the poetic beauty of this psalm cause you to miss the fact that David is viewing his battle against sin to be just as dire a situation as people seeking to murder him. Because David sees sin as what it is, an enemy just as dangerous, if not more, than people who would seek to end our lives. Both end in destruction. So, with this in mind, hear now the word of the Lord, Psalm 141. O Lord, I call upon you, hasten to me. Give ear to my voice when I call to you. Let my prayer be counted as incense before you, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. Set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips. Do not let my heart incline to any evil, to busy myself with wicked deeds in company with men who work iniquity. Let me not eat of their delicacies. Let a righteous man strike me. It is a kindness. Let him rebuke me. It is oil for my head. Let my head not refuse it. Yet my prayer is continually against their evil deeds. When their judges are thrown over the cliff, then they shall hear my words, for they are pleasant. As when one plows and breaks up the earth, so shall our bones be scattered at the mouth of Sheol. But my eyes are toward you, O God, my Lord. In you I seek refuge. Leave me not defenseless. Keep me from the trap that they have laid for me and from the snares of evildoers. Let the wicked fall into their own nets while I pass safely by. The word of the Lord. Okay, kids, all eyes up here. This time is for you too, right? Not just the grown-ups. So I got another one of my questions I always like to ask you. Are you guys really glad and thankful when your parents punish you? What? You're not? Saw some very shocked looks. Perplexed. Why aren't you thankful when your parents punish you? Because you don't like it, right? It makes you sad sometimes or makes you angry. Nobody likes to get punished. But do you think it would be good if your parents never, ever, ever punished you and just let you do whatever you want? Would that be good? Some good, honest answers out there. Excellent. I thought for sure we might have a few on the wrong side of that one. Why do your parents punish you when you do something wrong? Because they love you. And every parent sometimes does it not the nicest way sometimes, right? Because your parents are sinners too, right? Yep. But if your parents didn't ever punish you, you would turn into a really, really mean person, wouldn't you? Be really selfish, say awful things to people. You'd probably be violent and hurt people, right? It's a good thing that your parents don't want you to turn into a monster like that, right? They want you to be a kind and loving person. So if they see you being mean, what do they have to do? They have to help you not want to be mean, right? And so if they see you being mean, they have to give you a punishment because they want to change your heart because they love you. Our Bible verses that we read today for our sermon, King David from the Bible asked God to send people who would strike him. That means this. He was not serious that he wanted a punch in the face, but he said, God, I need people who will help me not want to be mean, not want to do mean things. So please send me people to help discipline me. You've heard that word discipline? It's kind of like punishment. Know what the Bible tells us? God disciplines people that he loves. He helps your heart change to not want to do those mean things. And sometimes that means you have to go through some tough punishments. But when your parents do that, it's because they love you. And ultimately, it's because God loves you. That he gave you parents to help you change. So next time you've done something wrong and your parents are punishing you, can you think in your heart, God, help me change so I don't do these mean things. And thank you that you gave me parents who love me. Think that might be hard to pray next time? It might be, but ask God to help you be able to have that kind of heart. And then the more your heart changes to be like him, guess what? The less you get punished, right? Because you're being more like him and your parents are seeing that your heart's changing to be like God. That's what they want for you, right? Okay. Can you think about that during the sermon for me? All right. Thank you for listening. So this psalm shows us how we ought to seek the Lord's help in our battle against sin. None of us does this well. And so we need all the help we can get in our battle against sin. So we'll look at three things that this psalm points out. So how should we seek the Lord's help in our battle against sin? First, we need to seek defense against our old nature. We would love if all of our sin came from outside influence, but it does not. So how do we seek help, defense against our old nature? That point we're going to dwell on a little bit longer than the others. So as you see the clock going, you're thinking, holy moly, we're still in point one. What are we going to do? Don't fret. Two, we need to seek defense from the attacks of the world. Now, again, don't make this a wagon circling moment that all the good Christians are here and all the bad worlds out there, we're not going to be like them. No, it's a worldly mindset that we're fighting that every one of us loves. And so we need defense against the allure of the world. And then we need to remember that in the midst of all the battle, all those things, remember, he keeps his promises to save. So, first point, how do we seek defense against our old nature? Again, look at the earnestness that David has in crying out to the Lord for this. Don't let that pass you by. Major feature of the psalm, O Lord, I call upon you, hasten to me. You see language like that so often in the psalms and you're ready for, the dogs seek my life, you know. Nope, it's not what's going on here. It's another kind of destruction. What our old nature and the devil and the world want for you. So, the first thing he goes to, set a guard on my mouth. How often is that something you're praying? Set a guard on my mouth. I think right away, we go straight to help me not gossip, or help me not use foul language, or help me not lie. And that's a battle every one of us, I'm sure, is facing. Those things are things everyone struggles with. But that, again, settles for so little. Because we should go beyond just not saying destructive things to saying helpful things, to saying encouraging, constructive things. How can I use my words, Lord, to not be destructive and to build others up? This might be melodramatic. I'm not trying to be hysterical here, but there might not be anything more powerful in the universe apart from God than words. God spoke the universe into existence. God spoke eternal life into you by pronouncing you to be just, thanks to Christ. Words can put nations at war. And words are really, really, really powerful for good and for ill. And words have caused people to take their own lives. Think about that. Mere words ended someone's life. Words have caused people to not take their own lives. Words have saved lives. I think we all treat our words as cheap, and the more trivial our communication gets culturally, the more you send an entire message with nothing but emojis, I don't think we view communication as a powerful thing. I'm not saying it's wrong. I've sent my wife full emoji texts before and see if she can figure out what I'm trying to communicate, okay? I'm not saying it's wrong, okay? But the more that becomes, communication becomes cheap. You don't think words are valuable. In the New Testament, words were expensive. It would have taken the Apostle Paul or cost him something between $14,000 and $16,000 to write the book of Romans. The words weren't as cheap back then, right? Communication was difficult. You had to value words when they were passed on to you. We don't do that today. So don't hear me blaming the culture for this, because at the end of the day, the culture can do whatever it wants, and our hearts should follow what the Lord calls for us regardless. So James, in a passage you probably expected me to go to once you heard we were talking about words, James chapter 3 gives a very important reminder of how powerful of an instrument our mouths are. James chapter 3, verse 2. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he's a perfect man. Also, able to bridle his whole body. If we put bits into the mouths of horses so that they obey us, we guide their whole bodies as well. Look at the ships also. Though they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are guided by a very small rudder wherever the will of the pilot directs. So also the tongue is a small member, yet it boasts of great things. How great a forest is set ablaze by such a small fire. And the tongue is a fire, a world of unrighteousness. The tongue is set among our members, staining the whole body, setting it on fire, the entire course of life, and set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and sea creature, can be tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse people who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening both fresh and salt water? Can a fig tree, my brothers, bear olives, or a grapevine produce figs? Neither can a salt pond yield fresh water. In typical James fashion, there's no word of comfort for you after that. James just means business. And he wants to get a hold of our attention and help us see how important it is that we pray David's prayer, put a guard on my mouth, because our words can do so much damage and our words can do so much good. So what does it mean? What are we asking for if we beg God, like David, to guard our mouths? Again, don't just view that as keep the bad stuff from coming out. It's yes, that's a huge part of it, but how can we use our words to do powerful things for the glory of God and the good of others? In Ephesians chapter 4, Paul's describing this contrast of the old man and the new man. And he's reminding us, as he often does, put off the old and put on the new. Live like who God says you are. You are credited to be as righteous as Christ. You're a new creation. Live that way. And after these beautiful exhortations he gives, the first thing he goes to is how we should be living as a new creation. Our words. The first thing he says in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 22. Put off your old self, which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through deceitful desires. Be renewed in the spirit of your mind. Put on the new self, created after the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. Therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor. For we are members of one another. And jump ahead to verse 29. Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. What does that mean? means before you speak, if you have the guard on your mouth that David is asking for, you would check to think whether your words benefit those who hear or not. They would give grace to them or kindness to those who are listening. Is that ever part of your mental thought process when you are forming what's about to come out of your mouth? Or is it just, here's what I feel like saying. So it's coming out. And whether it benefits you or not, deal with it. I have thick skin. I have really thick skin. I'm not bragging about it. The Lord has used it to do some good things. But to my wife's perplexity, whatever, she says, you just can't hurt your feelings. My wife is a sweet person. She doesn't try to, but it has shocked her. You just, for whatever reason, I don't get my feelings hurt. But that leads me to say all kinds of things that might hurt others because it wouldn't hurt me. So, is that what God calls us to? I'd be fine hearing this, so I'm just going to assume they're fine hearing it. No. I'm supposed to be gracious to them with my words and only say what benefits. Don't misunderstand what God's calling us to here. That does not mean just blow smoke and basically turn into a walking, you know, self-affirmation poster for everybody, okay? I'm convinced they don't do any good anyway. You may be called upon to say very hard things for people to hear. And that's what you're called to do, and that's what they need, and it will benefit them. And you might really pay for it. So it's not just say nice things to people. Ask the Lord for wisdom and compassion and say what benefits people. And that is very hard to do. Because we just want people to like us. We just want to say what's convenient. We just want to say what we think people want to hear. And sometimes what they want to hear will benefit them. So great. But often it's going to cost you. And David knows how difficult it is, and so he's asking God, put the guard over my mouth. Because what I want is to do what benefits me the most. How can I say things that get allies? How can I say things that shut down the people I don't like? How can I deceive people to get what I want out of this situation? And we use our words that way so often. It's a beautiful thing we are called to here in Ephesians 4. It's not just enough to stop the lying and the gossiping, although we must put a guard over that or beg the Lord for a guard over that. But say, Lord, how do I even begin constructing the way I talk to make it beneficial for others? It doesn't mean that all you can do is preach the gospel to people, but it means you actively look for who you can encourage. It means that instead of gearing up for your typical list of rights that you have before you show up to work that you know so-and-so is going to infringe upon, you gear and say, who can I encourage? Who needs building up here that the Lord could empower me with words to do so? Who needs confronting lovingly about the destructive behavior that I've seen? How can I humbly, after I've first investigated my own eye, be that for them? And whatever else, you look for ways to be honest with your speech, not deceitful, so you're only caring about yourself. And of course, you ask the Lord for opportunities in the midst of all those to be able to share the truth of the hope that's in you. Don't hear me saying sharing the gospel is off the table for this discussion, but it's not only that. But that's not the only thing David is asking. Yes, our words need to change. But David knows that our words don't come from our mouths. Our words come from our hearts. So he's also asking for a guard over his heart. He asked the Lord to incline his heart away from evil. What kind of evil is he talking about here? It's not just general. It's a little bit more specific situation. And I think it's what often trips us up with our words. The word used for men there in verse 4 is a word describing people of influence. highborn people. The people you want to impress, the people you want to be in good with. He says, help me not feast on their delicacies. But that is hard. Don't just think rich here, okay? Don't just think powerful. Think the people you bend over backwards at all costs to retain their favor. What concessions are you willing to make? How far are you willing to go to keep the people whose favor you've just got to have in good with you? And that's who we need to be thinking about here. And David sees how easy it is to just feast on their delicacies. We're used to hearing David ask God to what? Defend me from the enemies who are seeking my life, right? He's asking defense from these people too, but he's not afraid of violence. He's afraid of their friendship. He's asking defense from their favors because he knows what he wants to do with that. Go right along into approving of the way they live because you don't want to do without that favor. Take a moment of self-reflection here. Who are those people in your life? The people whose favor you've got to have and the people who you know full well you concede to. They might not be rich, powerful, evil people. But if valuing their favor ends up taking the place of valuing God's favor, we have a huge problem on our hands, don't we? And every one of us does it. We all value the approval of man more than we value the approval of God. This is deeply entrenched in us. And so often that's what causes us to use our words destructively. I know they're saying things I should not, but I'm talking right along with them because I can't afford not to fit in. I'm going to laugh right along with it. What's going on here? Because I can't afford to be the one person who brings this down as not enjoying whatever is being enjoyed here that's sinful. What do you choose not to confront for these people because you can't afford their rejection or the backlash? And what does David do in the face of this? What does he know that he needs for his heart to be inclined toward wanting God's approval over the approval of man? Send me a righteous man to strike me. Has that ever been a prayer of yours? Maybe not literally, but like, Lord, send me people. Surround me with people who don't let me get away with sin. That needs to be a prayer we all pray regularly. And what a beautiful thing it is. David's essentially saying this: I would rather the confrontation, the painful confrontation of a righteous person over all the favor and great smooth words and whatever else from the wicked. And when that's a group whose opinion is influential, one that you could suffer from if you don't have it, rarely ever you're saying, yes, send me the Christian brother who's not part of this powerful group to pull me out instead of letting them approve of me more. But that's what we need. That's why you cannot afford to take your involvement in this church lightly. I don't mean volunteering, though, yes, we always need more of those. I mean the fellowship, the interaction that Christians need to have because we are not designed to make it in this journey through the desert toward the promised land on our own. We don't have what it takes. It's why we push church membership here so often. We are not looking to pad numbers to send off to the PCA headquarters. Oh, wow, that does not matter. We want you to see that the Bible calls you to submit to your elders and your pastors because you need that kind of care. I'm so grateful that I have the presbytery, a bunch of guys who I can't pull rank with. If I attempted to pull rank with you, if you were to try to come confront me and I tried to say, what do you know, blah, 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 I'm the guy who studied the Greek and the Hebrew, that I'm surrounded by a bunch of guys who outrank me and I can't pull that there, and I know they can call my bluff if needed. So grateful I have that. Would never want to abuse the situation I have with all of you. We need this kind of companionship because we don't have what it takes to go it alone. We need to open ourselves up to it when it happens too. We're being confronted. What does David say? Let it be like oil on my head. I know that doesn't appeal to us really in our culture here, but it's a picture of something beautiful and soothing for them. And he says, and don't let my head reject it. We need to pray that. Lord, when discipline comes my way, please let my first thing just being self-defensive. Let me not first start thinking about what they've done wrong so I can not feel bad. Let me receive it. Let me not focus on, well, they weren't delivering it the right way. They had a tinge of arrogance in their voice. All that is dodging what we're trying to not admit to. Ask the Lord for not only people who will be giving you that kind of loving confrontation and encouragement, but that you would receive it well, which happens easily for exactly zero of us. I know I haven't conducted a poll on that one, but I'm going out on a limb and saying I'm right about that. This is why we need to remember that we can't just go. We're going to go focus on the world in a minute, okay? But all this whole point one has been, we're seeking defense against our old nature. Ask the Lord, change my heart to value your approval first. Then I don't have to care about who's approving of me. Your approval, I have. And so now I can just look out, who could I go benefit with my words then? How can I not seek to just make my own life as how designed as I want it by having the approval of all these people here and just go serve? Who needs my help? Because the Lord has my future secure. Your old nature doesn't believe that. The devil doesn't want you to believe that. Nor does our second point, the world. And so we need defense from our old nature, but we need defense from the allures of the world. Now, I'll say it again. I know I said it a few minutes ago. Don't think, yeah, I got to just stick around with all the good guys. I got to stop hanging out with those non-Christians. Hardly. I doubt any of us spends enough time with non-Christians constructively. So, verse 6 and 7 have frustrated every single commentator I read, and no one is thrilled with their own translation. It's difficult to figure out exactly what's going on here. But he's talking about this group, right? This rich, powerful, wicked people who he's fighting the desire for their approval. And he sees we need defense from the world that tries to drag us there. Verse 6, when their judges are thrown over the cliff, then they will hear my words, for they are pleasant. As when one plows and breaks up the earth, so shall our bones be scattered at the mouth of Sheol. Here's what's going on there. He's saying their way ends in destruction. And the truths they've rejected, once they're finally face to face with God, they're going to realize, that's what I should have known. And should we go along with them, all our bones are going to be scattered there at Sheol. We have to see, in defending against the allure of the world, where it ends up. We need God to remind us. We are looking after things, coveting what the world says gives you fulfillment, realizing all those things end in destruction. I'm not saying you're losing your salvation. I'm saying, why would I want to spend my time indulging in things that lead to destruction? Why would I want to find fulfillment in what God says leads to destruction? But we need his help to expose those kinds of lies. The world wants you to die with them. And that's why it's so hard to be the one voice in the middle of the room choosing not to go along with something that is destructive. They don't want you to remind them that what they're doing is wrong. They want you to enjoy the party while it lasts and then go down with them. And so when you are the one choosing not to go along with all the gossip in the room, you're going to get the reputation for being what? Oh, you're too good for that? And it's going to cost you. It's going to cost you. And that's when you realize, I have the Lord's approval. He has loved me like his own son. I don't have to make their approval an idol and let it destroy me that I don't have it. But it may cost you. God says, when the world hates you, know that it hated me first, and I will never leave you nor forsake you. We need to read Ecclesiastes often. We need to refamiliarize ourselves with what the truth about all the best success in the world, about where that ends up. Ecclesiastes isn't calling out a bunch of sin necessarily, that destructive behavior here, that destructive behavior there. It's saying, even if you achieve the best things in this world, they're not going to last. We need to re-familiarize ourselves with those truths. They're powerfully stated. Ecclesiastes is great for that. It reminds us that it's the love of God alone. That is where joy is found. So don't hear me saying, run away from the world's destructive behavior only. We need to also realize that the world wants you to make an idol out of the good things in this life too. Yes, the destructive behavior is bad, but if you idolize the spouse God gave you, then you're still acting like the world because your hope's tied to things that will pass away, which is also destructive. So we need God to help us realize, I can't put my hope in anything but you. Guard my heart from finding full joy in the allure of the temporal, the physical, and let me find it in what is eternal. That will come naturally to none of us. We naturally find our joy in what's right before our eyes, and so we desperately need God to help us think counterintuitively about this, reminding us that our hope is in the guaranteed future of Christ and not in even the very good blessings he's given us in this life, let alone the sinful things we so often chase after to find our fulfillment in them. He has designed you to never find fulfillment in this life. Full, complete fulfillment, that is. Is that cruel? It's a kindness. Remember, the Lord disciplines those he loves. That's why it's a good thing for him to send people to confront you. It's a kindness of God that he has said, if I let you find full fulfillment this side of heaven, you wouldn't look for eternity. It's good that God has done this for us. But it's not natural for us. So, our third point, we desperately need to remember that in the midst of these battles, which we lose so often, he will keep his promise to save you. Don't just think of salvation as the day I, you know, ask Jesus into my heart, okay? We're talking the whole picture where he says what? That which I started, I will complete. I am the author and I'm the finisher of your faith. We can't start this project and have it fail to come to perfection. It's impossible. We need to remember that, or we will keep sinking down to our failures and keep sinking down to the level of whatever is temporal, because it'll seem, the eternal will seem too good to be true. Where do we see that in this psalm here? Verse 8, but my eyes are toward you, O God, my Lord. In you I seek refuge. Leave me not defenseless. Keep me from the trap they have laid for me and from the snares of the evildoers. Let the wicked fall into their own nets while I pass by safely. And as David began his prayer, what? The Lord would hear him and receive his prayer as sweet incense. God has vowed to do that. He has vowed to hear our prayers, to receive them as sweet incense, and to destroy the forces of evil that attack us. So God will always hear your prayer. I know we talk about this to our kids, but do you see what an incredible value it is that you know God will always pick up? Got God's voicemail again. When is he going to finally hear my prayer and get back to me? Or it could be like many of you who tried to email me. God does not have a graveyard of good intentions labeled drafts. God always hears, and you don't have to wait in line. You don't have to qualify. You don't have to pray a certain way to find it. Okay, I got it all right. He heard that one. God always will hear your prayer. Why? Because you're his precious child. We get to cry out, Abba. It doesn't mean daddy, it means father, and it was a term only the children could use. And it's not just we're allowed to use the word, okay, it's actually we're allowed to cry. Paul shows you we're supposed to yell out, Father. Martin Luther has this beautiful passage where he says, there's nothing more beautiful to the ears of the Father than his children crying that out. It's a call for help. He has vowed to always hear your prayer. Why? Because he knows how badly we need it. What has he said in the moments of temptation he will always do? No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. We don't fall into temptation and sin because we cried out and God failed. It's because we didn't cry out at all, or we cried out half-heartedly. The way of escape that God provides, how often do we escape like Lot's wife? There it is. It's so clearly what I ought to say or do in this situation. And I take a half step toward it and decide, nah, I'd rather serve myself here. And it leads to destruction. It leads to destruction. We can count on our prayers always being heard because God receives them, as David asked, sweet incense. That's always a picture of things that God approves of, that God delights in. And you can know God will always delight in your prayers because he has covered you with Christ. You picture God being bored or uninterested or inattentive to Christ's prayers? God didn't have any more ear for Christ's prayers, even in the Garden of Gethsemane, than he has for yours, and receives them the same. You're like, but I can't pray perfectly like Jesus. What does the Bible say? The Spirit's interceding for you with words too deep to even express. Of course your prayers aren't perfect. Don't let that be a reason you don't cry out, either in preparation for situations that usually lead you into sin, or in the moment, or afterwards for forgiveness. Cry out. You have a father who sent his son who would be in the trenches with you in the moments of temptation so that he knows what it's like. What does Hebrews 2 tell us? Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Listen to this part here. For surely it's not angels he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. That's you. Therefore he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he's able to help those who are being tempted. He came down, suffered the attacks of the devil, won every battle of temptation for you so that you could have his record, and then died to take your penalty because he took your record. And now that faithful high priest represents you, so you know you have full access to the Father. So in moments of temptation, in situations that lead you to sinful patterns of thought, cry out in advance before you're there. Cry out in advance the day before, the night before, the morning of, knowing full well, don't trust your old nature to tell you you've got this. Put a guard over my mouth and my heart. Bring me people who will tell me the truth so I change, David says. And David knows the Lord will come to his defense. But will God cry out, will hear your cry if you're in the midst of a destructive situation that you solely caused by your sin? Can you even expect him to respond then? Or is he going to turn a deaf ear because he told you so? Don't project what humans do onto God. What does he say in Hebrews 4? Continuing to talk about how the faithful high priest helps those in the midst of their sinful temptations. Since then we have a great high priest, this is Hebrews 4:14, who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in the time of need. When you are lying about in the utter destruction of what your sin has caused, that's the time you run to him most. It's when the devil makes you think more than ever you have no access. God will not hear the prayers you're going to offer thanks to what you've done. That's when you run the most. He was with us in our flesh. And what is he sympathizing with? Successes? No, it's weaknesses. It's the weak who are to run to him. And that's all of us. So, God will also remember this. He will hear your prayers. He will receive them like Jesus himself is praying, but he also will keep his promise to destroy the evil one, to destroy the sin and death that the devil has caused, and this world will not stay this way. You have a guaranteed place with him. He He honors David's prayer to do what? Let them be destroyed and let me walk by safely. Don't think about people you want to be destroyed. Think of all the devil has wrought, all that sin has wrought upon this world. That's gone, and you pass safely through, like the people in the ark, through God's judgment to inherit a new life, free from the effects of sin and death. Satan will be destroyed by his own lies. Your old nature someday will be gone, and all the effects of sin and death on this world are going to be erased in a new world, replacing it, where you and I will dwell forever, rejoicing with each other and our Father. Ask the Lord to fill your heart and mind with that so that you long to speak in ways that honor him and you have a heart filled with joy from eternity and not from this world, which will pass away. It's a cry out, Abba. It doesn't mean daddy. It means father. And it was a term only the children could use. And it's not just we're allowed to use the word. Okay, it's actually we're allowed to cry. Paul shows you we're supposed to yell out, Father. And Martin Luther has this beautiful passage where he says, there's nothing more beautiful to the ears of the Father than his children crying that out. It's a call for help. He has vowed to always receive your, always hear your prayer. Why? Because he knows how badly we need it. What has he said in the moments of temptation he will always do? No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. We don't fall into temptation and sin because we cried out and God failed. It's because we didn't cry out at all, or we cried out half-heartedly. The way of escape that God provides, how often do we escape like Lot's wife? There it is. It's so clearly what I ought to say or do in this situation. And I take a half step toward it and decide, nah, I'd rather serve myself here. And it leads to destruction. It leads to destruction. We can count on our prayers always being heard because God receives them, as David asked, sweet incense. That's always a picture of things that God approves of, that God delights in. And you can know God will always delight in your prayers because he has covered you with Christ. You picture God being bored or uninterested or inattentive to Christ's prayers? God didn't have any more ear for Christ's prayers, even in the Garden of Gethsemane, than he has for yours, and receives them the same. Like, but I can't pray prayerfully like Jesus. What does the Bible say? The Spirit's interceding for you with words too deep to even express. Of course your prayers aren't perfect. Don't let that be a reason you don't cry out, either in preparation for situations that usually lead you into sin, or in the moment, or afterwards for forgiveness. Cry out. You have a Father who sent his Son, who would be in the trenches with you in the moments of temptation so that he knows what it's like. What does Hebrews 2 tell us? Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Listen to this part here. For surely it's not angels he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. That's you. Therefore he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he's able to help those who are being tempted. He came down, suffered the attacks of the devil, won every battle of temptation for you so that you could have his record, and then died to take your penalty because he took your record. And now that faithful high priest represents you, so you know you have full access to the Father. So in moments of temptation, in situations that lead you to sinful patterns of thought, cry out. Cry out in advance before you're there. Cry out in advance the day before, the night before, the morning of, knowing full well, don't trust your old nature to tell you you've got this. Put a guard over my mouth and my heart. Bring me people who will tell me the truth so I change, David says. And David knows the Lord will come to his defense. But will God cry out, will hear your cry if you're in the midst of a destructive situation that you solely caused by your sin? Can you even expect him to respond then? Or is he going to turn a deaf ear because he told you so? Don't project what humans do onto God. What does he say in Hebrews 4? Continuing to talk about how the faithful high priest helps those in the midst of their sinful temptations. Since then we have a great high priest, this is Hebrews 4:14, who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in the time of need. When you are lying about in the utter destruction of what your sin has caused, that's the time you run to him most. It's when the devil makes you think more than ever you have no access. God will not hear the prayers you're going to offer thanks to what you've done. That's when you run the most. He was with us in our flesh. And what is he sympathizing with? Successes? No, it's weaknesses. It's the weak who are to run to him. And that's all of us. So, God will also remember this. He will hear your prayers. He will receive them like Jesus himself is praying, but he also will keep his promise to destroy the evil one, to destroy the sin and death that the devil has caused. And this world will not stay this way. You have a guaranteed place with him. He honors David's prayer to do what? Let them be destroyed and let me walk by safely. Don't think about people you want to be destroyed. Think of all the devil has wrought, all that sin has wrought upon this world. That's gone, and you pass safely through like the people in the ark through God's judgment to inherit a new life free from the effects of sin and death. Satan will be destroyed by his own lies. Your old nature someday will be gone, and all the effects of sin and death on this world are going to be erased in a new world, replacing it, where you and I will dwell forever, rejoicing with each other and our Father. Ask the Lord to fill your heart and mind with that so that you long to speak in ways that honor him and you have a heart filled with joy from eternity and not from this world, which will pass away.